May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jessica Yates, bar number 38003, representing Valley Bank and Trust. With me here today at counsel table is Mike Lindsay, his co-counsel. There are a lot of moving parts to this case, but possibly the best place to start is who filed this action. It wasn't a voter claiming to have been hoodwinked by the 1996 ballot issue. It wasn't the Board of County Commissioners of Adams County claiming that the district had violated its service plan. Instead, it was the district itself, the very same entity that approved both its original and amended service plan, the same entity that upon its creation requested that the district court in Adams County forward ballot measure 5B to the voters, and the same entity that negotiated with my client, Valley Bank, on numerous occasions starting in 2003 to enter into loans and to pledge collateral in support of those loans. And this fact goes to two issues that permeate this appeal. One is whether the district even has standing to challenge what it perceives is its violation of its service plan. And we would argue it does not. And the second, of course, is the equities, because notwithstanding the very interesting legal issues presented here, it actually is just a case about a borrower that's trying to repudiate its debt. So I'd like to start first with the question of standing, because that is a question of subject matter jurisdiction. And the district here is arguing that the loans were invalid because they constituted a material departure from its service plan. But the Special District Act, Section 207, makes it clear that only certain types of parties and entities have standing to bring that kind of challenge. And it's undisputed that the district doesn't fall within any of those categories. It's not a property owner or a resident. It's not the Adams County Board of County Commissioners. It's not the district court acting on its own motion. So we can really just stop there with the question of standing, because regardless of what the service plan says or doesn't say, the district doesn't have standing to challenge its own action that it is now saying is not compliant with its service plan. But I would like to move on to another part of the standing equation, because it's in the Section 207. And it gives us a sense of what the General Assembly intended here.
I'm sorry, Ms. Yates, if I could interrupt you. Sure. Does it make a difference here that this wasn't a claim for an injunction? This was a declaratory judgment action. Does that make any difference in your standing argument?
Your Honor, I don't believe it does. This court has held on numerous occasions, as has the Supreme Court, that it isn't the letter of a pleading that counts, it's the substance. And really what the district is trying to do here is enjoin its own action in approving the loan. It is in fact trying to enjoin itself, but of course it can't plead that because you can't enjoin your own action. I would also direct the court to a case that we cited for a slightly different proposition, but it's also helpful. And that's the Romer versus Fountain Sanitation District case. We cited that in our opening brief for a slightly different proposition, but it also shows that even under the Declaratory Judgment Act, a district can't basically seek a declaratory judgment against the state because it's an arm of the state and its interests are thought to be aligned. Here, the district is effectively trying to seek a declaratory judgment against itself. Notice in this action, it's not asking the court to construe the Valley Bank loan documents. Instead, it's asking the court to declare its own actions invalid. That's really what's going on here. And so whether you style it as an injunction or a declaratory relief, there simply isn't any standing to do so, whether you look to the Special District Act or the Declaratory Judgment Act.
Well, the district is composed of homeowners, correct? Why can't the district just go in and say to the court, we messed up. We thought we complied, but we didn't. And now we're in a situation where we have a responsibility to our voters. We didn't do what was necessary for them. Should they have to go out and scrape up a couple of voters to do it for them?
Yes, Your Honor, we would submit as much. And there's also a statute of limitations issue I'm going to get to in a moment, even if they did have those voters. But I would direct the court to the County of Boulder versus City of Broomfield case that we cited, which also stands for the proposition that a county cannot bring a Tabor action, quote unquote, on behalf of its taxpayers. That case said you don't have standing under Tabor, and you can't claim representative standing on behalf of your taxpayers, because the statute is very clear in there. It's Tabor that's very clear about who has standing, and the court said it doesn't include you.
This is a good argument and important to us, but we're time limited. Can you assume for the moment, unless my colleagues have a question about standing, that there is, even if there is standing, could you go forward and address the merits?
Yes, Your Honor. And I just do want to touch very quickly on the fact that there's also a limitations, a time limitations involved in the statute and under the Supplemental Public Securities Act. But to get to your point on the merits, we can start with 32.1.1000 in the Special District Act, which provides the district with the express authority to enter into loans and to encumber its assets. And we can start and stop there with their merits question, because it's undisputed that that act provides the authority. The district is simply acting, claiming that it also has to be in the service plan. And that's simply not the case. If you look at Section 202, that it doesn't refer back to 1001. It doesn't require a district to restate those powers or somehow opt into those powers. But we can also look to Section 207 to get a sense of whether this is really a problem at all. Section 207 makes it very clear that the only kind of claim that's actionable is a material departure from the service plan. Here, we actually don't even have a departure, material or not, because the service plan never prohibited the district from entering into collateralized lending. It didn't address it one way or the other, but did have a catch-all phrase basically saying that the district was allowed to pursue any kind of legal financing as needed. So it provided that authority. Second, 207 says if you're going to make this an action, it has to be material. And we really don't think it's material by looking at the guidance provided at 207, which albeit doesn't provide an exhaustive list of what is and isn't a material departure, but it provides some good guidance. Something that is necessary for the execution of the service plan, that's not a material departure. Something that is revenue neutral or actually increases the ability of the district to repay its debt, that's not a material departure. And that can be inferred from the fact that what is a material departure is a reduction in the ability to repay debt. So those are the kinds of things that give us some insight. And here, collateralized lending is not a reduction in the ability to repay debt. As a matter of fact, from the lender's perspective, if you add collateral, it increases the ability to repay debt. And so then we get to the third prong of that inquiry that the Plains Metro case provides some guidance on. And the question is, was it practicable for the district to follow its plan? And it's only actionable under Plains Metro if the district shows it was practicable to follow its plan, but then somehow just disregarded it. And the record shows that the district had actually concluded that it wasn't practicable to follow its plan, because the plan provided for certain limits in terms of the revenue bonds, which the district repeatedly exceeded, both in terms of the timing and amount. So the district itself had concluded that its plan was not exactly working and needed to tweak its financial arrangements, and that's what the district did. I would like to turn for a moment to Section 6 of Article 11, because that is another component to the district's argument. And the district court's holding on this is premised only on one theory, and that's the idea that the voters were somehow hoodwinked regarding ballot issue 5B. And it really doesn't seem that that's the case, given that there are no voters in this case. No voter brought an action, no voter testified. There's no evidence that anyone was hoodwinked about whether the district could or couldn't pledge collateral. Instead, the district court effectively made a policy determination, which of course is not the prudence of the courts, instead of actually textually analyzing Section 6. And when you get to an analysis of Section 6 and the text, it's pretty clear that the district's argument fails. The clauses that provide for what must be in a ballot measure, specifying the purpose, providing the authority to levy a tax, those are the bare minimum requirements But there's nothing in there that also says, well, the voters should be notified of everything that they could possibly be interested in. That wasn't part of Section 6. Instead of that, the assets to be pledged phrase refers to the sufficiency of the tax that must be authorized by the voters. And the point of that is voters, if you're going to authorize the district to incur debt, you also have to authorize the district to impose a tax sufficient in amount when considered with revenues and assets as may be pledged to pay it back. In other words, you're going to have to pay it back. That's the message of Section 6.
Well, what do you do, Ms. Yates, with, and Mr. Forbes relies heavily on the McNichols case, and I understand your argument that it's distinguishable on its facts, but there is some pretty strong language in McNichols that says the question must be submitted to the voters, must be specific and apprise them of the particular, must be specific and in all essential particulars in compliance with the requirements of the statute. There's other language that kind of talks about you gotta be real specific and tell them everything. Now, I know you make policy arguments about that, but what do you do with that language in McNichols? There's some language that says you gotta tell them about the exact and particular thing on which they're voting. Mr. Forbes strongly focuses on that. So what's your response to that?
And I think McNichols was correctly decided because Section 6 does say you have to specify the purpose for which the debt is going to be incurred. That's actually part of Section 6. And in McNichols, the municipality provided language in the ballot about specifying the purpose and then turned around and used that language for something else altogether. That was a problem under McNichols, and I think that is fairly a problem under Section 6. The rest of McNichols, to the extent that it would suggest that everything needs to be in a ballot measure, probably is dicta. And there's also language in McNichols, of course, encouraging courts to not second-guess districts and municipalities about their financing arrangements. And I would also note that the bondholders in that case were not penalized. The penalty went to the municipality, not to the third parties that had been involved in that arrangement.
You and your opponent disagree on one thing, I believe, that my reading is, and that is how the district could have complied. When the district was formed, it really didn't have much to do. There was some general language. Later on, year by year, the collateral was pledged, and then the collateral kept changing. Your position is that you, under his theory, you would have to go back to the voters every year. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. That's our understanding of how the district court and the district would have us read Section 6, that assets as may be pledged have to be specified, and therefore the specific assets that are going to be pledged have to be itemized for the voters.
Does the district know what assets will be pledged at a given time? Looking at the practicalities here.
Your Honor, it does seem that the district is unlikely to have known what assets would be pledged in 96 because that's the year that it was created. And that's part of the maturing process for districts. And if you look at the Special District Act and look at how cases have implemented that, there has to be some flexibility on the part of districts to respond to financial changes. And Section 6 isn't inconsistent with that. That's pretty clear from the language because you only have to specify the purpose and also provide the authority for a tax.
Your opponent also attached an appendix of a vote that appeared to have some collateral laid out. You have other exhibits that show that there was not so much detail. Is this something that goes county by county? Is that your understanding, that each district decides what to put in its ballot?
Well, there is the discretion on the part of the district, and of course that gets approved from the district court when it's being created. But our point is there needs to be statewide guidance on this issue because lenders can't rely on what's in a ballot and what one county may choose to do in another.
What are you asking us to hold?
Your Honors, we're primarily asking to reverse the district court and hold that the loan is valid, that it should be enforced, and that the Valley Bank can move forward with all the remedies it's entitled to under its loan documents.
I understand you want to win, but what is the law that you want us to articulate?
Your Honors, it could be as simple or as broad as this court sees fit. There's a simple question of standing that could be the basis for it. Or the court could decide that Section 6 of Article 11 doesn't require the assets to be pledged, to be itemized, or that the voters have to approve the initial decision to impose collateral at all. And the same with the Section 207 of the Special District Act, that a district has the inherent authorities under 1001 to actually encumber its assets through a loan and no further actions needed.
How much information should the voters get?
Your Honor, judging from Section 6 alone, it is the fact that there's going to be a debt by loan, that there's going to be a specific purpose that's provided for, and providing for the authority of a tax in a sufficient amount to repay the debt when considered with revenues, assets as meekly pledged, and other funds. Your Honors, I intended to reserve time for rebuttal, but I see that I'm out of time. Are there any other questions?
Yes, there is. Okay. I have a question. Does your standing argument apply to your Section 6 argument?
Your Honor, that's a great question, and there's no authority on that one way or the other. It does seem that the Section 6 cases that have been brought by somebody other than the district itself, and that would sort of lend itself.
Did you argue standing with respect to Section 6 or just with respect to the Special District Act?
Your Honor, we didn't argue standing with respect to Section 6. We did with respect to the Special District Act and the counsel's argument in opposition on appeal with respect to the ambiguous language of 5B. That was an argument that was made, and we are arguing that they have no standing to argue that either.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Ms. Yates. Thank you. Well, I'd like to give, if I can, Mr. Mead, why don't we give Mr. Forbes 2 minutes extra, so we'll give you 17, and we'll give you a minute for rebuttal, Ms. Yates. I recognize they don't do this in the federal court, but we like to hear from counsel.
That's why we like the state court. Good afternoon, good morning, Your Honors, excuse me. Been here a while, feels like the afternoon. Peter Forbes on behalf of the district in this case. And I want to start by first putting this case in context. It was stipulated by the bank below that this was a good faith dispute. This arose when this loan was being renegotiated. Then if you look at the record, what happened is that they seized the district's funds. We were then forced to bring an action, essentially defensively, seeking to declare the obligation invalid. I think you'll also see, when you look at the cases, that illegality is a defense, is an issue that can be raised by any party to a transaction. Indeed, it can be raised by this court on its own motion. So certainly we have standing to raise the legality of this obligation, whether it was legally incurred. There are, I think, many interesting constitutional and statutory construction questions in this case. But as the Colorado Supreme Court, like most courts, has repeatedly said, you don't reach those questions if there's a way to decide the case without reaching them. And here, there is exactly such a way to decide this case, because it is fundamental that where a vote of the electorate is required, and nobody's denying that a vote of the electorate was required here, the only transactions that are authorized are those approved by the electorate. So the first thing we have to do in this proceeding is to determine whether the electorate approved secured financing, approved a pledge of district assets. Now, we raised this below, we argued it below, the district court below did not reach it. Perhaps because the issues were so interesting, he felt that would be more fun for a judge or more interesting for a judge. And by the way, as an aside, I've told people about this case and they say, yeah, that must be interesting for lawyers. and truly it is. But the point I make is that when you look at the actual language of the ballot here, it cannot be construed in any reasonable way to approve secure transactions. And I say that with some well-established principles in mind. First, our Supreme Court has directed us to say we have to look at what how a reasonable voter would interpret this. In other words, it's the voter's intent that we're trying to determine. So we don't give special meaning to language that would be beyond the ordinary meaning of the language. We interpret things not to read or authorize undisclosed transactions. We must not read ballots to authorize transactions not clearly disclosed. We can't rely on ambiguous language to find that there's authorization for transactions not clearly disclosed. And there's another rule of construction that's been applied, which is when you have a series and you define a principal object of the series, then general language is qualified by the specific language. Here, we have something saying that they ask the voters to approve issuing general obligation debt or other obligations. But it went further and said, here it is, payable from ad valorem property taxes, levied against all taxable property within the district by a mill levy, etc., together with any other legally available revenues.
So let me ask you, Mr. Forbes, if I can, how is the ballot issue here inconsistent with Section 6 of the Constitution? Doesn't it exactly track what Section 6 says you need to do?
Well, my point here is whether or not it's consistent with Section 6 isn't the issue.
I understand your point, okay. But I'm just, obviously your colleagues across the aisle there disagree with you, but I'm trying to, I mean, Section 6 is the first place to start as to what a political division needs to put on a ballot.
Interestingly, Section 6 doesn't even discuss what a political subdivision needs to put on the ballot measure. Section 6 has two parts. One part says you've got to have an irrepealable resolution specifying the amount of the debt and the amount of taxes you're going to levy in order to pay the debt, which in the view of the council, city council or district council, would be sufficient along with whatever assets and other security are pledged, are sufficient to make repayment. Then, as a specific sentence, as a different sentence, all it says is, no such debt shall be created unless the question of incurring the same be submitted to and approved by the voters. So Section 6 really begs the question as to what needs to be in the ballot measure, because it just says such debt and the same.
And it defines, I'm just playing devil's advocate here with you. I mean, before that, it defines what the debt needs to be and talks about irrepealable things you just mentioned. And I guess maybe it's a separate question because I do understand the argument you're making. But what would you, so as a separate question, what in the ballot measure was inconsistent with section, the actual terms of Section 6?
Well, assuming that what you're talking about is the first section of Section 6. Well, again,
or anything, however you want to define it. Right. Your first argument is they violated Section 6.
Well, actually, my first argument is that the ballot, you don't read Section 6.
Yes.
Because the ballot
I may have misremembered your brief, but I thought that was the first argument in your brief. Anyway.
I flipped the order. They started with that, and I flipped it saying you don't need
Fair
to
enough.
Get there. But assuming that we get there, the question is, what does the resolution need to provide? I mean, does the resolution need to call out that you're going to pledge assets as well as impose a tax levy? And I think the answer to that question is yes, as shown by the McNichols case. And the follow-on case in McNichols, which is the, I'm terrible with case names, but the follow-on case with McNichols where they approved the plan without the the pledge, Broadhead, the Broadhead case. They talked about there the resolution at issue said that they could pledge assets, said they would pledge assets. Okay, so I think what we're trying to do here is make sure that the voters know what they're approving, and that's runs through McNichols and Broadhead as well.
But McNichols, take for the example, I mean, the case, as Ms. Yates said, dealt with, they said we're going to, I may have this backwards, but we're on the ballot, so we're going to raise money to fix up the hospital. And then they used it to build a different building or whatever else.
Right.
And the focus, I mean, as the I know you quote the language that I was talking about, you know, the exact, whatever it said, apprise the voters of the exact and particular thing, but it says the exact and particular thing upon which they're called upon to vote and decide. And it seems to me that at least arguably that was in the context of talking about the purpose. And so you're drilling down, and I understand your argument, but I'm not sure McNichols goes as far as you say. So push back.
Sure, because what we're looking at, then we look at Broadhead, when the court says there's a fundamental difference between pledging the income from a facility and pledging the facility itself. And the fundamental difference is when you pledge the facility itself, you are putting public property at risk. So the question is that the type of thing that is the voter should be required to vote on? And I think Article 11, Section 6, in discussing the fact that it's not just the tax revenue measure that has to be considered, but if you're considering assets to be pledged, it's got to be part of a package. I think the reasonable way to read that, and particularly when you look back at the history of this and what it was designed to do, I mean, it was designed to protect the public against municipal councils subjecting the taxpayers to bankruptcy, or subjecting the assets to loss through bankruptcy, or subjecting them to taxes that they hadn't agreed to. So the protective purpose of Article 11, Section 6 is served by saying, yes, if you're going to pledge assets, which you're entitled to do under Article 11, Section 6, the voters need to approve that, because that's fundamentally different than just having a tax revenue measure.
Can I ask you then to address the policy issue? Do they have to have a vote every time the assets change?
Let's back up, because there's several points at which they've raised this issue about impracticality. First, you don't have to have this approved at the time the district is approved. You can always do it subsequently. Second, you can structure a ballot measure to identify assets, and because of the one we attached is an example of that, where we're going to pledge these assets, and that you can take a pool of assets you're going to pledge. The McNichols case had the same thing, where they said we're going to pledge the building plus the revenue from the parking meters. So, but let's say you've done that, and you've pledged a whole group of assets, and then you want to substitute collateral. I think that unless, and most of these ballot measures they submitted give some discretion to the authorities to rejigger the terms of these loans. My personal view is that if you were going to change collateral, that yes, indeed, if it was going to change the assets of the district or pledge, you would have to have a new ballot, because now you're changing the assets that are at risk, and so you should be required to get it. Now, would that be infeasible? No, because what you do in the beginning is you have a broad enough asset pledge that it doesn't need to happen. But if it does have to happen, so be it. So be it. It's not unusual. The ballot measures they submitted, for example, have taxes that expire. Well, they didn't, when they put those taxes in effect, they didn't anticipate needing them or needing to change them or needing to extend them. But when the time came and they still needed it, yes, they had to go through the process and get the vote again. So there's no parade of horribles here. There's you can describe the assets, this whole idea that you have to give value to the assets. That's, I think, just a fiction. You don't have to, when they do say, you know, shall we raise tax revenues, you don't put in a financial model in the ballot and say, here's why we think these will be adequate revenues. It's just a fiction. That's not necessary. That's not the material part of it. So the parade of horribles is just not there. Even if one assumes, and then the other thing I find interesting myself is when you look through the case law, this is a pretty unique situation where you're pledging assets. Most financing for special districts is done through revenue bonds or bonds secured by assessed valuation, ad valorem property taxes. So this is a pretty unique situation. So this other whole idea that we're going to be upsetting the apple cart and putting Colorado special districts behind some kind of eight ball is, again, a fiction. That there's no evidence that that actually is the case. Certainly there's no case law evidence that that's the case. I think the ballot measure is the first point, that this wasn't validly authorized. Second point is the Special District Act, and there's still some fundamental questions about the Special District Act that they really haven't addressed. Did you have a question?
I do have a question. Thank you, counsel. My question is, I'm not sure you've addressed their argument about lack of standing to claim a violation of your own authorizing act, or perhaps even estoppel. Should your client have been estopped from claiming a violation, or that it had violated the Special District Act?
I'll answer your second part of your question first. There is no estoppel when it comes to illegality. There are several decisions, recent decisions by this court, that hold that. They,
Are they cited in your brief?
No, because the issue really wasn't raised in the brief. I have them.
I'm sure we can find them then.
Okay. In thinking about the independent view that this panel always gives to arguments, I tried to think of new angles, and that was one of them. But there's a 2012 case, a 2010 case, and then there's some old Supreme Court cases.
That's okay, counsel. Okay. I agree with Judge Roth.
Basically, they say on illegality, estoppel is not against illegality. I'd also point out that with all the cases in which the courts have reached the issue, clearly estoppel is not a defense because the courts have reached the issue and invalidated many transactions on the basis of these provisions. The second question, on the standing question under the Special District Act, that is a question that I think is closer. I think that there, as a practical matter, it should not be determinative in this case because a court can raise the issue sua sponte. And in this case, the court, in its findings, did recognize that he was one of the entities that was entitled to raise these questions.
He was, but he didn't raise them.
Well, that's an interesting, point because he addressed them.
Right.
And it's hard to say, did he address them? Did he ignore their argument? Did he dismiss their argument? Did he intend to do it himself? He basically just reached the issues.
Okay.
Under the ground that you could sustain on the basis of anything in the record below, one could interpret, I think, the record as saying he elected to proceed in light of the standing argument, indicating that he decided that this was a situation in which he could proceed and address these issues.
Does it make a difference, do you think, that the district is a public entity as opposed to a private entity? Because the district made representations year after year that they had the authority. Now they're saying, we were just wrong. We thought we did. No bad faith on either side. But does it make a difference if it had been a private party?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
Here's my view. If this had been and I had some cases several years ago involving illegality, under Colorado law, the general rule appears to be in a private party transaction that the parties are left where the court finds them. That is, that there's no relief that can go either way. The one difference here is that there is a narrow exception to that rule that under which, in some narrow case circumstances, none of which are present here, there can be a recovery. Now, there's an additional issue in this case because of the CGIA issue that we've raised, which is a subject matter issue. But I think that's the difference, that there is, they did have a narrow path that they could have gone down. The facts here just don't support that path for many reasons, and we've addressed them both. But just to emphasize, this is not a facility built entirely with their funds. If you look in the record, that the attachment to their summary judgment motion was an example of the bond issue that described the source of the funds used to build the record, page 490. It says the district put its funds into this facility first, then it took some funds from them, and then it was going to add some of their own funds later. So it's not all their funds. Second, they were paid off. The money that they used, that we borrowed from them to use to build these facilities, that was all paid off. Then we borrowed it again, and there's no evidence of what we used that money for. So the situation addressed by the case law is not present in which relief can be granted.
Counsel, can I ask one question?
Yes.
And the question is, why can't we, say in the interest of justice or otherwise, why can't we essentially sever the collateralized part of the agreement and make this an unsecured debt?
What happens there is that you can make it an unsecured debt but it would have to be a Tabor compliant debt, which means that it would be in our discretion as to whether to pay it any particular year.
You're not saying that the debt wouldn't have been encompassed within that first ballot, 5A or 5B, would you?
Yes, because if it's a debt, it would not be encompassed within that ballot because it is, we cannot have a general obligation debt in this district because we lack the power to impose ad valorem property taxes. So what type of debt could we have? The only type of debt we could have would be a non-general obligation debt, which would be a Tabor compliant debt, which would be an annually renewable in our sole discretion debt, because otherwise it would violate Tabor. I'd also point out, Your Honor, that the issue on severance was not timely raised below, that there's issues in Colorado case law saying you can't sever when there's an integral, that's one integrated transaction. And in addition, I don't think the circumstances under which this court can grant relief allow that type of severance, because it's the obligation itself that is void. And once the obligation itself is void, then the only narrow path to relief is the narrow one recognized in the case law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Forbes. Ms. Yates, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. To start backwards in terms of response, counsel for the district indicated that the district lacks the authority to impose an ad valorem tax. That's actually not true. Section 6 and the ballot measure 5B that complied with it provided the district with that authority. The service plan indicated that it was choosing not to exercise that authority, but the service plan didn't actually deprive the district of the authority to impose that tax. I also want to respond to the question of did the district court sua sponte act on its own authority here? As it's already been observed, that's not really supported very well by the record, but it also would be inconsistent with Section 207 because that conflates standing, which is an express standing requirement, into a venue requirement. Any party, somebody who doesn't even live in Colorado, could go in to challenge supposed noncompliance with the service plan, as long as they did it in Adams County District Court, and say, oh, well, it was the court acting on its own motion. And that's clearly not what was contemplated by the General Assembly in Section 207.
How would the General Assembly have contemplated the court doing it on its own motion?
Your Honor, it looks like from the statute, the General Assembly had in mind that this is the district court that blessed the creation of the district, and so it's acting in that capacity. Presumably, if the district learns, whether through public notice or reading in the newspapers, of something that appears to be not in compliance with the service plan, then it could act on its own motion as effectively a supervising court.
Or if you hadn't asked for that particular relief and you had asked for other relief and come into court, the court could have said, well, on my own motion, I'm going to raise this.
Presumably, Your Honor, that would be another way it could come to the attention of the court.
Correct. Because judges normally don't go out looking for lawsuits.
This is true, Your Honor. And I just want to point out in the last point that the district here is not asking to be forced to reballot its issue. It's not being asked to amend its service plan. It's being asked to invalidate a debt that it knew was occurring all along and to consider a posture of that as well. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Yates, and thank you, Mr. Forbes. We appreciate the briefs of all counsel, including counsel for Amici in this case. I also want to thank counsel for your professionalism and civility here today and for your excellent oral arguments. They're very, very helpful to the court. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.